Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We are about to talk with Danielle McGuire. Her book, when I saw it, just grabbed me immediately. I started reading it, and it really hit me because of how it has opened a door, not just in a story that too many of us know about sexuality and the South and race and rape, but this opens the door to the struggles that it led to and the power it led to. Danielle McGuire has written the book At the Dark End of the Street, Black Women, Rape, and Resistance, New History of the Civil Rights Movement from Rosa Parks to the Rise of Black Power, and she is an assistant professor of history at Wayne State University in Detroit. And Danielle McGuire, welcome. Good to have you with us. Danielle there? We have her up. Hi, Danielle. Do we have her? Can we bring her up? Hi, Danielle, you there? Okay. See if we can get the phone from her. Well, I'll tell you about the book until we get her up here on the air. Dan McGuire has written a book that, you know, we think that Rosa Parks and the story started in Montgomery with Rosa Parks, but that's only part of the history of who she was and what she did, and the stories that really make the heart of this book, which is kind of the soul begins and ends the book. Here is the story of Recy Taylor. There was a struggle that Rosa Parks was a deep part of and pushed as secretary of the NAACP chapter, and it's the way it begins. A woman who was gang raped by a number of white men, and the story of her struggle to fight that rape. Do we have Danielle back with us now?
Yes, I'm here.
Danielle, I'm sorry. Glad to have you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
So yeah, it's really a pleasure to have you on the air with us. And let's start with that. This is, we know, I mean, all too many people have written about this, too known a history about rape as a terror tactic in the South against black women. But you give it a different context. And let's talk about the context of Rosa Parks and Recy Taylor.
Sure. It's 1944. Abbeville, Alabama. Recy Taylor is an African-American woman. She's walking home from a church revival. A car full of white men kidnap her off the street, drive her to the woods, and they gang rape her at gunpoint. When they were finished, they dropped her off in the middle of town, and they told her that if she told anybody what happened, they would shoot her dead. But she didn't, you know, get too afraid. She told her husband, she told her father, she told the local sheriff the details of the assault, and within a week, the local NAACP branch, which was in Montgomery, called to say they were sending their very best investigator. That person was Rosa Parks. It was 1944. It was 11 years before the bus boycott. And so Rosa Parks came to Recy Taylor's house in Abbeville. She took notes on what happened, and she carried the story back to Montgomery, where she and the city's most militant activists organized the Committee for Equal Justice for Mrs. Recy Taylor. The Chicago Defender called it the largest campaign for equal justice to be seen in a decade. It was a national story.
It's a national story that we've forgotten until you brought it back to us.
Right.
On my way back there, I'm going to come right back to Rosa Parks and Recy Taylor, because this is a story that's it's a bookends of your book. Mm. And I want to talk about those bookends and what you've done with that. But one of the things that I think that's interesting for me is your sojourn to all this. You were a graduate student. You're studying African-American studies, right?
Right.
And you came upon a story.
I came upon this story. Yeah, I was listening to NPR. I was listening to the radio, and I heard the editor of the Montgomery Advertiser talking about an important woman to the bus boycott, and I thought he would say Rosa Parks. And instead of saying Rosa Parks, he said Gertrude Perkins.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, who on earth is Gertrude Perkins? So I did some research, and I found out that Gertrude Perkins is an African-American woman who was walking home from a party in 1949, and two white Montgomery police officers kidnapped her and assaulted her. She went and told her minister what happened, and he got together with E.D. Nixon and other activists in Montgomery, and they launched a public protest that kept the story in the front pages of the white newspapers for 2 months. They forced a grand jury hearing. Of course, the men were not indicted, but it was the first time all the ministers were really shook up. And what I realized after I, you know, read that story and, you know, put the pieces together was that people like Rosa Parks and E.D. Nixon and all the people who had become famous for the Montgomery bus boycott, they all cut their political teeth defending black women from sexualized violence and in the decade before the bus boycott began.
This is, going back to Rosa Parks, I think this history of how this was used as a terror tactic in the South is something that needs to come to the day, see the light of day from the dark end of the street, as you write. And going back to this particular story, I mean, this is, you know, we think of the rape of African American women in the South as one of which it was of oppression and of terror. But what it led to, I think, is really what you're bringing to the light of day, which is how it led to the organizing of political power, of a movement fueled by women who resisted.
Right. I mean, you see this being used, rape as a political weapon, as a form of terror, from slavery through the better part of the 20th century. And what's fascinating to me, and what's fascinating every time I found another story, was all of the women who spoke out. So, you know, from Harriet Jacobs during slavery to Ida B. Wells during Reconstruction, all the way up to Fannie Lou Hamer in the 1960s, who spoke out against a brutal beating while she was in prison, just testifies to Black women's incredible courage and their strength and fortitude to speak out against white supremacy and to use their voices as weapons. And the fact that they did this way before the women's movement, you know, way before rape became a kind of public political issue, is testament to both their ongoing struggle and their desire for freedom and dignity.
So here we're going back to Recy Taylor for a moment. 24 years old. Mm-hmm. She was a mother. She was coming home from church, kidnapped by these men and raped. And as you talk about towards the end of your book, there was a huge discussion in her family about what to do once this happened. Mm-hmm. I want to spend some time with this story so we can kind of really let this unfold as kind of the underpinnings of what you're telling America with this book.
Yeah, it's a really incredible story. You know, she, like I said, she told people what happened despite the fact that she was threatened, you know, her life was threatened, and she refused to be silenced. And when I asked her why she, you know, told, she said, "I just didn't think I deserved what they did to me. I was walking home from church." She said, "I'm a good citizen. I didn't deserve what they did, and so I had to speak out." And Rosa Parks came and took notes on what happened and took it back to Montgomery and launched this national campaign. And labor union activists were involved. People in New York were involved. The NAACP was involved. You get this really incredible eclectic coalition that comes to the defense of Recy Taylor. They launch a national campaign that basically embarrasses the governor of Alabama enough to force a private investigation. He sends his own private investigators to Abbeville, and they come back and they say, "You know what? We interviewed the assailants, and they did it. We believe they did it. We believe that she's telling the truth." So they force a grand jury hearing, but the white men in Henry County who made up the jurors refuse to indict them. They're their neighbors. They're their sons. They're their, you know, nephews and people that they know, and they can't believe that a Black woman can be raped. They just can't believe it because they have stereotypes that are rooted in slavery about Black women being over-sexualized and that Black women wanted white men to rape them. Of course, none of this is true, but they just can't get out of that mindset. So they're never indicted, and Recy Taylor is still alive. She'll be 91 this year, and she's still waiting for justice. She's still waiting for these men, you know, to pay for what they did. The whole family, I think, is still angry about what happened, and the violence and the ramifications of that violence just resonate across generations.
And hello,
we're talking about a governor who of Alabama who was forced to bring this up. It wasn't as if he wanted to defend Black women.
That's right. He was forced to do it
in the 1940s. In the 1940s. Now, one of the things you also talk about, this is during the war, World War II.
Right. This,
and you also write about the men who, the African-American men who fought for America in this, from the Deep South in segregation, and hear this story. And their reaction to this story was just as amazing,
right.
Also part untold.
Part of the reason why they're able to get any traction with this case is because it is during World War II, so that they can draw attention to the, you know, deep chasm between the rhetoric of American democracy and the reality of American racism. So you've got Black soldiers who are fighting for democracy abroad, but they can't get a simple trial at home. So, you know, this resonates overseas where the soldiers are, and they write home and they say, "How can we be defending America here? How can we be fighting Nazism and fascism abroad when we have our own Hitlers here at home? We have our own fascists here at home that we need to deal with."
We're going to take a brief break. When we come back from this break, we're going to talk about WEA Radio and why you need to support your public radio here in this town at WEAA. When we come back, we're going to talk about a number of women who were raped in the South, how they fought back, what happened to them, the fight to free women who were imprisoned, who fought their white attackers back and fought being raped while in prison. We're going to talk about what it meant to recognize and fight against the sanctity of a black woman's body, because it was the key to social equality for races in the minds of white men, and they didn't want having that happen in the South. In this incredible book, At the Dark End of the Street, by Danielle McGuire. Stay with us. Right now we have to come back with Marcella Shepard, and we're going to talk to you about why WEA is important in your life. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, you can go to www.mecu.com. We are here this hour with Danielle McGuire. Her book is At the Dark End of the Street, Black Women, Rape, and Resistance, A New History of the Civil Rights Movement from Rosa Parks to the Rise of Political Power. And I'm going to come to the subtitle in a moment, but I really want to kind of walk our way through Recy Taylor and get to the other stories in this book, Danielle. And because Recy Taylor's story here, I mean, this resistance that this woman, along with Rosa Parks, had, I mean, led to two trials. Neither one brought her justice, but it really stood up to the face of segregation and white power in the South. And it's a story that needs to be known.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, these are important stories that civil rights historians have mostly ignored, despite the fact that black women at the time talked about them publicly in black newspapers and in the courts, in churches and courtrooms. And so...
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Danny. It's just cross lines. Just keep going. I'm sorry.
Yeah. The voices of the past were so clear, and somehow historians have really tried to, I think, push them out of the story for some reason. You know, we focus on notable leaders and national organizations, but we ignore the things that ordinary people were complaining about and the things that were very important to them. So, you know, ballots are extremely important and voting rights are extremely important, but it doesn't matter if you can't walk down the street without being molested. So bodily integrity is just as important as is access to the polls and access to public accommodation.
I want to talk to two larger issues that are involved in this, and I'd like you to speak to what you've written about here. One is that what you wrote about in terms of the sanctity of a black woman's body that was really kind of stoked. The anger about that was stoked by race-baiting journalists and segregationists who really saw this as a danger. If they were allowed to kind of look at that, the power of black women and the sanctity of the right to control their own bodies was a threat to the entire world of segregation.
Absolutely, because white supremacy basically sat on top of this idea that African Americans were not human and that black women could not be raped, that black women were not human beings, just like black men were not. And so they used this myth of rape, this fear of interracial sexuality, to maintain their own power and control. And in that way, they not only controlled black women's bodies by using rape as a weapon of terror, but they also used the fear of black men as rapists to control white women and white women's bodies and to maintain their position of power. So sex really sits at the center of white supremacy. It's the foundation of it.
It's amazing because what you're also laying open here is the idea that the myth has been perpetrated about black men raping white women throughout the South when it was actually the other way around.
That's right. What white Southerners did really was they projected their own crimes and their own deviant behaviors onto black men and women in order to maintain their power.
And also the other piece I want to talk about before we move on to other parts of the book is that the heart of the Montgomery bus boycott movement were black women, and
that's right.
Part of what fueled it was this anger to defend themselves, and that's what kind of was the underpinning of this movement.
That's right. Well, you know, we often don't stop to think about why so many thousands of black women stayed off the buses. you know, what was it about the buses that were so awful? Well, one of the things that happened on the buses regularly was sexual harassment and sexual abuse. Black women were mostly working class, and they didn't have cars, and they had to get to mostly the white side of town because many of them were domestics and worked for white people. So buses were the bane of black women's existence, and they were sites of sexual violence. So if we want to know why thousands of black women stayed off the buses in Montgomery, we need to understand this history of sexual abuse.
And you're interviewing other women who took part in that boycott, many of them, though. Once it started, Martin Luther King and other black men in the community kind of took the leadership of the movement and what became the face of the movement. It really wasn't something that caused a schism between black men and women. It was something that said that black women supported.
That's right. I mean, I think that what happened is that black men were denied public roles and leadership opportunities so often in the segregated South that when reporters came calling in Montgomery to see what had happened, black women who were the organizers of the boycott, who were the chief strategists and negotiators, they stepped aside and they let their ministers and other black male leaders in the community take that public leadership position. They were happy to do it in a way. You know, they knew that the men would take it over anyhow. That was just sort of the gender politics of the day.
Right.
But they were happy in many ways to let them have that position because it was denied to them for so long.
You can join us here at 410-319-8888. Make your pledge, but you can also talk here during the course of this hour with Danielle McGuire about her book, At the Dark End of the Street, Black Women, Rape, and Resistance, A New History of the Civil Rights Movement, From Rosa Parks to the Rise of Black Power. Let's talk about some of the other people that you talk about. You talked a bit about Gertrude Perkins in the beginning, 25 years old when she was raped by two policemen in 1949.
There's women across the South. I came across stories in just about every town and every state across Jim Crow. And in Montgomery, in 1951, a black teenager named Flossie Hardman is brutally raped by a white man named Sam Green. He owns a grocery store. And he employs Flossie Hardman as a babysitter. Well, one night after work, he drives her home. He pulls to the side of the road, and he brutally assaults her. She went home. She told her parents, and they took the case to court. Of course, the jury refused to indict the man, but African-Americans basically decided that they were going to render their own verdict, and they boycotted his store, and they shut it down in a matter of weeks. So they established the boycott as a precedent, you know, 4 years before the bus boycott, and they sent a message to other people that they weren't going to allow this to happen any longer without consequences. So that's just Montgomery. I mean, there's cases everywhere else, too.
Well, you have an entire chapter, because it's such a critical story, the story of Betty Jean Owens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Betty Jean Owens. It's 1959. She's a student at Florida A&M University in Tallahassee, Florida. And she's on a date. She's on a double date. And they're parked with their dates, as, you know, dates are known to do. And a group of white men creep up on the car. They've got guns and knives. And they force the black couples out of the car. And they debate which woman they're going to kidnap. They decide on Betty Jean Owens. And they throw her into the backseat of their car. They gag her with a baby diaper and drive her outside of town and again brutally gang rape her. And in the meantime, her friends go to the police, and there's an intern on duty that night. They find the assailants. They chase them through town. He gets them to pull over. They basically admit to doing it. They laugh at the police station. You know, they sign the confessions. They don't think they're going to get in any trouble. But students at Florida A&M University basically think otherwise. They force the local prosecutor to call a grand jury hearing. They have a public protest on campus where they demand protection for black women, and Betty Jean Owens gets her day in court. The assailants are charged with rape, which is a capital crime in Florida. Owens testifies on her own behalf, and they're found guilty. It's one of the first cases in the South where white men get life in prison for raping a black woman. Of course, they didn't stay in prison for life, but the verdict was a watershed event and ought to be recognized as a major civil rights moment.
And just to put the men's names out there, it was Patrick Scarborough, David Beagles, Ollie Strudemeyer, and William Ted Collinsworth were the four men who raped her and were later convicted.
Three of whom are still around. One is in prison, one is on supervised parole in Alabama, and one is just free.
It's that in this, though, the story, one of the powerful moments in these stories, and particularly this story, was so complex, was because as you wrote, it plunged the white and black world, that moment, into a world they did not expect. Nobody was prepared for this, for the students standing up, mm-hmm. and for what happened at this trial. This was really a groundbreaking moment.
It is a groundbreaking moment, and it really fractures the infrastructure of white supremacy. You know, the political foundation of white supremacy is sexual violence, and here the myth is exposed. It's not black men who are rapists; it's white men, and it's not white women whose sanctity needs to be protected. It's black women whose
right.
bodily integrity needs to be protected. So it throws the whole argument for white supremacy out the window.
We're going to take a short break and come right back to hear more of this story at the dark end of the street by Danielle L. McGuire, a professor of history at Wayne State University, Black Women, Rape, and Resistance, New History of the Civil Rights Movement, from Rosa Parks to the Rise of Black Power. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. That's an important number in the midst of this crazy mortgage crisis that we're in. Save your home and call that number. We're talking right now with Danielle L. McGuire. Her book, At the Dark End of the Street, Black Women, Rape, and Resistance, a New History of the Civil Rights Movement, from Rosa Parks to the Rise of Black Power. You know, I just want to tell you, Danielle, I deeply appreciate this book. As someone who was a civil rights worker who fought in that battle in the early 60s, to bring what you're bringing to light sheds an analysis on that struggle that we haven't heard before. When you see the stories of people like Rosalie Ingram that you write about, who killed a white man in 1947 defending herself. It took all those years to make her free in 1957, but that's part of the story as well.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And there were other women who defended themselves from sexual violence and sexual attack, and sometimes with weapons. One of my chapters focuses on Joanne Little, who
right.
used an ice pick to get away from a man who brought the ice pick in to attack her while she was in prison. And there are lots of women who kept guns. I just got an email from a woman who told me that as a child in Montgomery, her mother told her that if white men ever followed her and if she ever felt in danger, she should run to the nearest house and seek refuge. And one day she was coming home from school. She was 11 years old. And a carload of white men were chasing her and yelling insults. And she ran to a black lady's house and knocked on the door and told her what was happening. And the woman came out in 5 seconds with a double-barrel shotgun and shot into the air. And she said, "You should have seen those white boys scatter." So there were lots of incidents in which black women fought back, you know, on their own behalf, sometimes armed. There were times when black men stood up for black women and defended them when they could. And then, of course, there are all the moments of testimony in which black women use their voices as weapons to fight back.
And you have a story here that you tell. It's in around – there's Open Season on Negroes now, that chapter, in Chapter 4 of your book. And you tell the story of Melba Petillo, and in there you talk about, we're not allowed to use the N-word on this station, but that epithet for black folks, wanted to go to school with his children, and he wasn't going to stand for it, and he chased her, and she tripped on her shoelaces. I mean, it's a horrible story, and it's just really a horrible story, but that people fought back around that one as well.
That's right. And, you know, she becomes a heroine of the Little Rock campaign, the desegregation struggle a couple years later. It's the day that the Supreme Court issues the Brown decision, which outlawed segregation in public schools, and a white man goes chasing a little black girl, arguing that integration is going to ruin, you know, the United States, and he tries to rape her. And it's just, you know, it's a perfect example of the ways in which whites use their power and their fear of integration and fear of interracial, you know, understanding, and then takes that and twists it into something horrible and awful and brutal. And you know, he's so worried about integrating. Why is he trying to attack a black girl? And I saw that happening again and again. The defenders, the fiercest defenders of segregation, were often the very people who were guilty of what African Americans called nighttime integration. They were guilty of sneaking around in the black community looking for black women to sleep with.
Daniel, we're going to, my producers across the glass want to give you a call right back because there's a bad connection. We're going to get you back in the line within 30 seconds, okay?
Okay.
I'm going to call you right back. And we're calling Daniel McGuire back, who is the author of At the Dark End of the Street, Black Women, Rape, and Resistance, A New History of the Civil Rights Movement from Rosa Parks to the Rise of Black Power. When she comes back online, we're going to talk about some of the things that really were kind of earth-shattering these changes. And what we have to talk about is, and other people have done their books about the press, is the role of black newspapers in the 40s, 50s, and 60s fighting this, and the role of the left-wing press, of the press from the unions and the press from the perspective, from that perspective, who would not let these issues go, who would not let the issues of the rape of black women go as the heart of this movement, and put them on the forefront of the struggle in this country. And so we want to, as soon as we get her back on the air here, we're going to dive right into that subject. So even though the connection's bad, let's just keep her on the air because we don't have much time here on a day like today. 410-319-8888 is the number here you can call to have a conversation with Daniel McGuire as well as make your pledge. And Danielle, what I said was, while we were getting you back, was that there's something that you write, there's another subtext to this book, which I think is powerful. It's in this story in Little Rock, but goes through many stories, which is the story of the African-American press, the story of the black press in America that wouldn't let these stories go, and also the story of the left-wing press in America fighting for black liberation wouldn't let these stories go either.
That's right. I mean, the black press is so crucial to so many of these things. I mean, the black press ends up being a kind of megaphone for black women who are testifying about these crimes. And I wouldn't have been able to find or track down a lot of these stories if it weren't for archived copies of the Chicago Defender and the Baltimore Afro-American and the Pittsburgh Courier and other black newspapers around the country, because that was really one of the only outlets that publicized these kinds of attacks, because white newspapers would mostly ignore what was happening to black people, you know, in particular, and then black women especially. So the black press is really, really crucial, and they helped me stitch this narrative together.
And I think that that's one of the things that really hit me. The reason it means so much to me, that part of the book, is that we forget, I think, in America, the role the press should play, which is the role of the crusading press for the rights of the oppressed in America. And I think that's the role that you're kind of putting out again for us to see the light of day, the role that was played by certain partisan press and certain parts of the black community and black press really kind of played a vital role in all of this.
An absolutely vital role. And we forget about how, you know, black newspapers help to shape black leaders. So, you know, when we think of Daisy Bates, we only think about the Little Rock school desegregation crisis. But Daisy Bates, her husband, ran a black newspaper in Arkansas. It was a very popular black newspaper. And for the decade before the Little Rock school integration, she used her newspaper as a kind of bullhorn to announce what was happening to black people in their community. And she particularly focused on rape cases. So even our most, you know, cherished heroes and heroines of the movement were often fighting this kind of sexual violence before we really figure out what's going on.
Now, you also talk in this book about and it's interesting you put that in here, because is Viola Liuzzo and her murder as a white civil rights worker in the South. And I was interested in how you kind of wove the story into the story, because it's connected.
It's connected. Because it's based on that white fear of interracial sex. So Viola Liuzzo is part of the Selma to Montgomery march, and she's part of that voter rights campaign in 1965. She's a white housewife from Detroit who just hears the call one day and decides to go south. And she's parked at a stop sign after ferrying voters back and forth between Montgomery and Selma, and she's with a young black man named Leroy Moton. A car full of Klansmen see her in the car with a black man, and they just go crazy, and they basically decide they're going to murder her. So a high-speed chase ensues, and they point their rifles outside of the window, and they shoot into the window, and they kill Viola Liuzzo. The car goes careening off the road and into a ditch, and Leroy Moton is alive. He waits until the Klansman leaves. He gets out of the car. He flags down the next vehicle. It happens to be Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee workers, and they take him back. But what's so fascinating is that the FBI had an informant in the car that night, full of Klansmen, And when they found out that they murdered a white woman, J. Edgar Hoover and his other agents basically went about blackening Liuzzo's character. And they turned her into a kind of black woman. They discredited her. They accused her of being a Jezebel. They did all kinds of things in order to discredit her in the courtroom.
I think that's, again, we forget about that because we like to kind of paint the Mississippi Burning movies kind of painted the FBI as a heroic organization. The civil rights movement was anything but at that moment in our history. And I think that's also these things you're laying out for us to understand, I think, are you're playing the role of a historian that needs to be played, which is to unearth the history that we don't want to talk about or that we have forgotten or want to forget.
Yeah. These are the kinds of stories that have been, I think, under the rug for far too long. And as Malcolm X said, these kinds of things need to come out from under the rug, put them on top of the table so that we can talk about them and so that we can have a kind of truth and reconciliation committee, really, with these kinds of incidents in the past. You know, South Africa can have a truth and reconciliation committee to talk about what crimes have happened, then I think we can do it too. And it's time that we did that.
No, that's really important. I mean, the idea that this can lead not to vengeance, but to truth and reconciliation, to letting the truth come out. I mean, I think about that a great deal. I was thinking about that in terms of the men who raped John Little, now out, free some of them. That maybe it's time for them to come out, the police to come out, all of us to come forth and begin to reconstruct our society by telling the truth and opening it up so we can have so we can move ahead.
Absolutely. I don't think there's any way we can move forward as a nation, as a people, unless we come to terms with our racial history. And when we talk about our racial history, we can't just talk about, okay, there was slavery, and yes, there was segregation, and now we've moved on into this post-racial society. No, there was a lot more to it. And there are people who are still living with the pain of the violence and violation that was part of white supremacy and was part of a...
Sorry. So there? Did we just lose our guest? Well, let's get her back on the line. Let's take a brief break and talk about WEA for a few minutes while we get her back on the line and finish this incredible conversation about this incredible book with Danielle McGuire, who's bringing a piece of our history to light that needs to be brought to light. Starting now, 410-319-8888 to show your support for your public radio. Welcome back. We're still here with Danielle McGuire, her book At the Dark End of the Street, Black Women, Rape, and Resistance, A New History of the Civil Rights Movement, From Rosa Parks to the Rise of Black Power. And Danielle, I understand you dropped your phone, but I'm glad you're back.
Sorry.
It's all right.
I need to pay my phone bill.
So finish what you were saying about the resistance and the power, what this book was saying, what you were in the middle of as we went to break. I'm sorry.
I don't even remember what I was
saying. That's all right. We were talking about Viola Duyoso, but let me switch gears on you. And I think that one of the most moving parts of this book, the fact that you went back and the women you interviewed, women who had been victims of these rapes, of this kind of terrorized crime of rape against black women in the South, you interviewed them. These women are now in their 70s and 80s mm-hmm. and still
and
going.
90s.
And 90s.
That's right. Recy Taylor will be 91 this December 31st. And there are other women who, like you said, are in their 70s and 80s. And I think that just goes to show that this is an ancient history. This is not something that happened, you know, centuries ago. This is something that
right.
happened to people's families. Everywhere I've gone so far since the book came out, I've talked to other women who tell me that either they were assaulted as a young woman, or their mothers were the products of rape, or their grandmothers were assaulted. So this kind of behavior and these actions have really, I think, they're forcing us to deal with them because this is not so long ago. These people are with us, they're alive, and they deserve justice.
And you're talking about, in some cases, our wives, in some cases, our mothers and grandmothers we're talking
That's
about,
right.
that close to us.
That's right, absolutely. And And what I'm finding, too, is that for younger women who are reading the book, if they take it home with them or they're with their grandmothers will say, you know, I have a story to tell you. And it's the first time, maybe, that they've heard the story in the family. When I talked to Recy Taylor, her grandchildren didn't really know what happened to her in 1944 until I came for the interview.
Really?
And then the whole family gathered, and everyone found out what happened, and Recy told everybody the details of the assault. And they were angry. They were really angry. They were proud of their grandmother, you know, for the stand that she took in 1944, as they should be, because what she did at that time was so brave for a woman and for a black woman in particular. But they were angry. They were really angry. And so this crime, I think, just echoes out for a long, long time.
And you have a lovely piece at the end of the story, end of the book, where Recy Taylor was, and you watched Barack Obama and the speech, and you watched Michelle Obama's speech. And tell us that story.
It was so wild. I didn't know that I would get to meet her. I hadn't found her. Her brother called me, and we talked for a long time on the phone, and then we agreed to meet. We happened to meet them the same day that Barack Obama was inaugurated as the country's first African-American president. And we were watching the inauguration on television before we went to retrace the steps of the evening that she was attacked. And I turned to Recy and I said, did you ever think you would witness this moment? Did you ever think a black woman would become first lady? And she looked at me and she shook her head and she said, not in my lifetime, not ever. And that's because throughout American history, black women were not considered ladies. They were never given the dignity and respect they deserve. They were never, even during segregation, when you had white women's bathrooms, you didn't have black women's bathrooms. You didn't have a black ladies' bathroom. Black women were denied that simple title. And because they were denied that title, they were treated with the utmost disrespect and violence. So to have Michelle Obama ascend into the White House as America's first lady, I think, is incredible. It forces everyone to call her a lady, everyone around the world, but also it shows, you know, the centuries-long struggle of black women to gain that kind of dignity and respect. And I think it's something they're still fighting for. It's certainly something Michelle Obama's still fighting for, even in the White House.
It seems in many ways, as I read this book, that I could feel history unfolding for you. Something that this was a seminal work, not just in terms of what it's giving us, but in terms of what it did to you, I think.
Yeah, it changed me. I started working on this as a kind of naive graduate student in my early 20s, and I had no idea that this is something I was going to work on. I didn't know the story. I didn't know there was a story. And there's something about, I think, encountering evil and seeing the way ordinary people fight against it that is both inspiring and shocking. And you grow as a person, as a human being. I learned a lot about humanity and, in that sense, inhumanity as well. And I grew to love and admire the women that I write about, some of whom I've met, some of whom I'll always just admire from a distance. You know, they'll always sort of be my angels.
Mm-hmm.
but it also taught me something about historians and the things that we ignore and the things that we like to cover up because of our own uncomfortability, our own silences, our own distance from crime or violence. I'm not sure, but well, yeah, it definitely changed me.
I mean, you become the historian as activist. Not just a detached academic.
Right, absolutely. It was impossible to do that with these stories. I mean, you can't stand on the sidelines and not get involved in some way or another.
When you write about Joanne Robinson, you write about what happened there, and we only have a couple minutes left, but I wish we had more time to talk about this. I mean, because I think fearless as a historian bring out people like Louise Thompson Patterson, who was a communist and the wife of William Patterson, the Civil Rights Congressman, and Beulah Richardson, the poet and Progressive Party activist in Mississippi in 1951, when you could be killed for being a Progressive Party activist in Mississippi.
Right.
And I love the way you bring that out to all of us to kind of consider and not shy away from it.
Yeah, I think it's important that we know that McCarthyism and the Red Scare didn't kill leftism. It didn't kill progressives. It didn't knock them out of the spotlight. They continued to do their work, often underground, often quietly, but it didn't kill the movement. It just slowed it down a little bit. So in times when it seems like the politics are turning against progressivism or against the liberal liberalism. I think we all need to hold on to hope that there can be a brighter day.
Danielle McGuire, author of The Dark End of the Street, Black Women, Rape, and Resistance, A New History of the Civil Rights Movement from Rosa Parks, The Rise of Black Power. Thank you so much for being with us today. We look forward to talking to you again.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. And folks, keep calling 410-319-8888. Show your support for your public radio, WEAA. Let us give you this book as our gift to you for your pledge of $100 or more. Become a manager-level member of WEAA. Read a bit of history and be part of history by supporting your public radio station, WEAA, at 410-319-8888. We'll be right back. Stay with us.